I'd like to call the House Committee on Healthcare Subcommittee on Health Policy to order, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3099. Good afternoon, everyone. Marjorie, could you describe the bill for us?
Absolutely. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3099 requires that water suppliers serving more than 10,000 people add fluoride to their water, and it also clarifies the responsibility of DHS relating to drinking water. And I would like to call your attention to the fact that there are two stacks of emailed and written testimony at your place at the dais, and one of the packets is in support of House Bill 3099, and the second is in opposition.
Thank you, Marjorie. And for the sake of time, we would just take note of this, that we have written testimony that we're going to put in the record in favor of, and in support, we received two items in support and 65 in opposition. So, everyone, I appreciate you being here today. Here's what we're going to do. This is a complex and somewhat contentious issue, and the goal is to hear both sides equitably in the course of 2 hours. We're already a few minutes behind schedule. So what we're planning to do is we have a proponent panel and an opponent panel. So we're going to start off with the proponent panel. Proponents will have until 3:45. And that includes the panel and any public testimony that we might have. We have several folks signed up for public testimony, so the goal will be to get through as many as we can. I have a timer. We're going to try to keep people to 2 minutes. I would urge the panels to keep it brief as well, to leave some time for the public testimony if they can. At 3:45, we will have an opposition panel. Same protocol. Try to hear the panel. Leave some time for public testimony. And then we'll have about 10 minutes at the end for pro and con rebuttal to catch some of the issues that have been raised, pro and con individual. And then we have plans to potentially move this to work session at the end of the hearing today. So that's kind of the timeline. And I appreciate that everyone is here and wants to be heard. And if you can be brief when you talk, that would be super helpful. So thank you. With that, let's start off with Dr. Empey, Dr. Pollack, and Dr. Herringer. Whoever wants to start, just state your name for the record and let's get going.
Chair Kotek and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Gordon Empey. I'm a dental health consultant to the Public Health Division, here in support of community water fluoridation. I also wear another hat, and then I'm a member of the recently developed Oregon Oral Health Coalition, which is also in support of this legislation. Fluoridation of community water supplies is the adjustment of the natural level of fluoride ion in drinking water to an optimal level recommended by the U.S. Public Health Service. That range is 0.7 to 1.2 parts per million to prevent tooth decay. Approximately 170 million people in the United States drink fluoridated water, which represents about 67%. CDC estimates that the 2006 community water fluoridation consensus will show that about 70% of Americans are currently drinking fluoridated water. Oregon only has 20% of its residents drinking fluoridated water. We rank 48th out of 50 states. Despite this low percentage, we have a long history of community water fluoridation in Oregon. Currently, approximately 41 drinking water systems fluoridate, serving about 725,000 residents. The communities of Salem, Sublimity, Coquille, Forest Grove, Florence, Astoria, and Corvallis all have been fluoridating their water successfully for over 50 years. In addition, we have another approximately 35 water systems in Oregon serving about 50,000 individuals that have naturally occurring fluoride levels that are such to prevent and help decrease tooth decay. Passage and implementation of this legislation would result in an additional 25 water systems serving about 2.3 million direct customers and customers served by consecutive systems to drinking fluoridated water. This would bring the percentage of Oregonians drinking fluoridated water to close to the national level of 68% and get us ever so close to that federal Healthy People 2010 public health benchmark goal of 75%. 60 years of research, including recent research on community water fluoridation, has found it to be effective, safe, and economical. Tooth decay can be reduced from 18 to 40% according to studies, and is effective and economical with children and adults in reducing decay. Adjusted fluoridation of community drinking water has been a major factor responsible for the decline of tooth decay we've seen over the past two decades. About 5 years ago, a health economist from the Center for Disease Control developed a model methodology to estimate the cost savings of dental care that could be achieved by community water fluoridation. A few states have since used that methodology to assess dental claims for restorative procedures and make have made assumptions based on science concerning the reduction of tooth decay to estimate potential dollar savings as a result of community water fluoridation. I'm here today to say the oral health program, using Oregon-specific data, has replicated portions of that study and that methodology to determine estimates for the state of Oregon. The study concludes that Oregonians in non-fluoridated communities spent about an estimated $15 million annually on restorative care, that's for cavities, fillings, and crowns, that could have been prevented by community water fluoridation. Oral health statistics about Oregon children reflect the high rate of decay, as I was here a couple of months ago, as I recall, talking about the burden of oral decay in Oregon. 56% of children 6 to 8 year olds have experienced decay in Oregon. By age 15, that percentage has grown to 69%. Children with severe decay suffer more than just physical pain. Speech is affected, self-esteem deteriorates, school absenteeism can result, and many kinds of foods becomes difficult. We see long-term effects to tooth decay as well in elderly populations. Among Oregonians age 60 and over, 18% have lost all their teeth to preventable dental disease. Oral disease is also associated with chronic diseases, including heart disease, diabetes, and systemic infections. Among pregnant women, oral disease may be associated with increased risk for preterm delivery or low birth weight babies. A little bit about the drinking water program safety program regulations. Oregon Drinking Water Program tracks compliance of local water systems that fluoridate in several ways. Three of those ways are: systems are required to monitor for fluoride concentration levels daily. Systems are required to perform quarterly split samples to confirm local test findings by sending a sample to the contracted state lab for comparison. And thirdly, the drinking water program conducts sanitary survey inspections every 3 to 5 years to check on equipment and safety measures. Every reputable national and international health organization recognizes the benefit, or nearly every reputable international organization recognizes the benefits of community water fluoridation, and I have submitted a list of those organizations to you in my testimony materials. This impressive list of recognized organizations is based on repeated assessment of science based by independent committees of experts, as well as periodic review by findings of individual studies and research by agencies such as the Center for Disease Control and the U.S. Public Health Service and other reputable scientific organizations. It is the body of evidence, more than the findings of any single study, that affirms that throughout the lifespan that fluoridation is effective. Community water fluoridation is most valuable public health measure because optimally fluoridated water is accessible to the entire community regardless of socioeconomic status. Individuals do not need to change the behavior to receive the benefits of community water fluoridation. Frequent exposure to small amounts of fluoride over time makes fluoridation, community water fluoridation, effective throughout the lifespan, and community water fluoridation is more cost-effective than other forms of fluoride. With the committee's indulgence, I would like to indicate that Dr. Bill Moss, who is the director of the Division of Oral Health for the Center for Disease Control, who came 2 years ago to testify in favor of community water fluoridation, has submitted some testimony from the CDC for you, and I've provided that along with my testimony as well. And with your indulgence, I'd like to read just a couple of very brief statements from Dr. Moss. Dr. Moss says the CDC has recognized fluoridation of drinking water to prevent dental caries as one of the 10 public health achievements of the 20th century. Over the past 50 years, adjusting fluoridation of community drinking water has been a major factor responsible for the decline in tooth decay. Although other fluoride-containing products are available, water fluoridation remains the most equitable and cost-effective method of delivering fluoride to all members of most communities, regardless of age, educational experience, or income level. Dr. Moss goes on to say, in the course of collecting information, you, the committee, will hear assertions from two sources, and you should make a clear distinction between them. One source is self-proclaimed experts who single-mindedly, regarding this issue, who rely on their own interpretation of articles and who quote selectively from what other individual scientists have said. The other source is drawn from reports prepared by teams of distinguished scientists who are selected on the basis of their expertise to look at all scientific evidence of these issues and who debate the evidence as they draft the report. Before the study is completed, other independent scientists evaluate both the method they used in reaching conclusions and the specific conclusions reached. We, CDC, have a high confidence in the evaluation of the science that occurs through this process, whatever their findings may be. In the case of community water fluoridation, every such panel of experts that has met to review and critique the evidence has concluded that community water fluoridation is safe and effective.
Thank you, Dr. Empey. And I forgot to mention to the committee members, if we could do the panel, and it'll be five individuals, and then if you could just write down your questions, and then we can call whichever ones back up so we can get through all their presentations first, that'd be really helpful. Thank you.
Madam Chairperson and members of the subcommittee, good afternoon. I'm Dr. Howard Pollack. And there's a PowerPoint coming up, I assume, any second.
Any luck at all.
So, I'm a clinical professor at the University of California, San Francisco School of Dentistry, and today I'm here on behalf of the American Dental Association, which is the nation's largest dental association. We represent over 70% of the dentists here in the state of Oregon and over 155,000 members nationwide. The American Dental Association unreservedly endorses the fluoridation of water supplies, of community water supplies, as a safe, effective, and economical public health measure in preventing tooth decay. As the cost of health care continues to be a concern in our country, it's no surprise that states across the nation have turned to community water fluoridation for cost-effective preventive oral health care. I'm going to briefly cover three topics today: fluoridation from the national perspective, how fluoridation works, and the safety of fluoridation without the benefit of the slides. From the national perspective, recognizing the ongoing need to improve health and well-being, the U.S. Public Health Service has established national health objectives, I'm sure you know, to be achieved by the year 2010. One of the ways they hope to meet this goal for oral health is by significantly expanding the fluoridation of public water supplies. Specifically, one objective is to provide fluoridated drinking water to at least 75% of the U.S. population on public water systems by the year 2010. Today, about two-thirds, as has been mentioned, of the population served by public water systems have access to optimally fluoridated water, and that's more than 170 million people in the United States, and that number continues to grow. As you've heard, the CDC agrees that community water fluoridation is a safe, effective, and economical way to prevent tooth decay for all citizens. Water fluoridation protects teeth in two ways: systemically, or before teeth erupt, and topically, or after teeth come into the mouth. Recent studies indicate that the maximum reduction in tooth decay is achieved when fluoride is incorporated into the enamel of developing teeth before they erupt, making them more resistant to decay, and after teeth erupt to aid in the repair of early tooth decay. The fact that fluoride protects teeth in two ways makes it a valuable tool in protecting not only children's teeth, but adults' teeth too. Frequent exposure to small amounts of fluoride over time makes fluoridation effective throughout the lifespan in helping to prevent tooth decay. As a noted researcher stated, there is irrefutable evidence in numerous studies that fluoride in drinking water works to reduce dental caries in populations, and that noted researcher on the slide would have shown you that that was Dr. John Featherstone, who's my boss at the University of California, San Francisco. Simply by living in or even near a fluoridated community, people can benefit from fluoridation's cavity protection, whether they're at home, work, or school. Throughout more than 60 years of research and practical experience, the overwhelming weight of scientific evidence has consistently shown that fluoridation of community water supplies is safe. We know that the appropriate amount of fluoride is essential to prevent tooth decay, but like a lot of things in life, it's possible to get too much of a good thing. Fluoride intake above the optimal level creates a risk for enamel fluorosis, a cosmetic condition. Fluorosis occurs only during tooth development before teeth erupt through the gums. Teeth have already erupted and not at risk, and nor does fluorosis worsen after teeth do come into the mouth. Fluorosis affects only the way the teeth look, not the way they function. In the vast majority of cases, fluorosis appears as barely noticeable faint white lines on tooth enamel. In fact, the effect is so subtle that usually only dental experts can spot fluorosis and distinguish it from other cosmetic variations during a close visual inspection. Enamel fluorosis occurs among some people in all communities, even in communities that do not fluoridate and have low levels of naturally occurring fluoride in the water. The ADA wants everyone to be aware of what steps can be taken to reduce the risk for enamel fluorosis. For example, young children under the age of 6 years should use only a pea-sized amount of fluoride toothpaste at each brushing and be taught to spit out rather than swallow toothpaste, and where water is not fortified with fluoride, to accurately prescribe and take only the recommended dose of fluoride supplement. In November 2006, the ADA issued interim guidance for parents of infants who are not breastfed and who are primarily fed infant formula reconstituted with tap water, because recent estimates have shown that they might develop some level of enamel fluorosis. Parents who reconstitute infant formula with tap water, when this is the primary source of nutrition for their child, must weigh the proven decay prevention benefits of fluoridated water against the potential for enamel fluorosis. The occasional use of infant formula mixed in this way is not considered a risk factor for enamel fluorosis. Parents should consult with their pediatricians, family physicians, dentists on the most appropriate water to use for reconstituting infant formula. As a side note, I must tell you that the ADA is very concerned that some people have mischaracterized its recent interim guidance and used it as a springboard in efforts to stop fluoridation. This is not a warning that infants should not drink fluoridated water. The bottom line is that it is important to have fluoridated water to help prevent tooth decay that can be a very serious disease. Let me restate and emphasize that the ADA endorses water fluoridation as a safe and effective measure to prevent tooth decay and urges that its benefits be extended to all communities. It's the most economical means to provide these benefits to all segments of the community. Our ADA members, like many of you, have families, including children and elderly parents. We care for them just as you care for your families, and fluoridation can help protect them against tooth decay and tangibly improve the quality of their lives. When presented with an opportunity to provide people with a safe, demonstrated, and cost-effective healthcare program that benefits everyone, there can be no doubt as to why states and communities across the nation have chosen to provide their citizens with the benefits of community water fluoridation. It works, it's safe, and it's economical. Your support today of House Bill 3099 will be seen as an important event in the efforts to bring this important public health measure to the citizens of this great state. Thank you for allowing me this opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you, Dr. Pollack. And can we get a copy of your written notes?
Sure.
That would be great. Thank you.
Can I just add one more thing?
Mm-hmm.
There's been some concern about water fluoridation in the environment, and I have brought with me a publication that I authored on water fluoridation and the environment, the current perspectives in the United States, and I can offer that.
Thank you. We'll get copies to the committee. Thank you very much. Dr. Herring, good to see you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Kotek and members of the subcommittee. I speak in favor of fluoride. My testimony is really a personal testimony.
My name is
Dr. Weston Herringer, Jr. I'm a native Oregonian raised in McMinnville. I graduated from dental school at OHSU in the class of 71. After 4 years of active duty in the Army, I attended a two-year hospital residency in pediatric dentistry in Dayton, Ohio. I returned to Oregon in 1977 to practice. I am currently director of a new pediatric dental residency at the dental school at OHSU. I spend 3 days a week in Portland, practice 2 days a week with my son here in Salem, who is also a pediatric dentist. I am board certified and past president of the Oregon Dental Association. From 1977 to 2005, when I started up at the dental school, I split my practice time between Salem, which has fluoride in the drinking water, and Lincoln City, which does not. Over the past 10 years, I've taken numerous trips with Northwest Medical Teams, have worked in orphanages in Cambodia, Mexico, and Romania, and during my active and reserve Army career of 22 years, I've treated patients in Alaska, Arizona, California, Colorado, Oklahoma, Ohio, Oregon, the Panama Canal, Washington State, Brazil, Bolivia, Chile, Germany, Panama, Paraguay, and Uruguay. It is usually easy to recognize after an oral exam who has had fluoride in their water and who has not, whether I am here in Oregon or elsewhere. When I would see a middle-class child in Lincoln City, the child almost had twice as much tooth decay as that middle-class child in Salem. Children of lower socioeconomic groups usually have even more decay. After working 28 years in both a fluoridated and non-fluoridated community, I saw the difference on a weekly basis. Tooth decay is a disease that is preventable. Fluoride in the water works to help prevent tooth decay and the resulting tooth loss. Tooth decay results in the loss of chewing function and causes infection, which affect a patient's overall health. As a pediatric dentist, I see that early problems associated with dental decay and oral disease. Abscessed teeth, pain, space loss, missed days of school, and resulting self-esteem issues relating to ugly black, brown, and rotten teeth and the smile of a four-year-old. Children with healthy mouths just do better. I was recently able to provide care for two twin-year-old girls in a Head Start program here in Salem with the American Dental Association's Give Kids a Smile event this last winter. Both girls had decay in 14 of their 20 primary teeth with some abscesses in their molars and incisors. They recently had moved to Salem from another area. After completing two of their five treatment visits that they each needed, the teachers at school, the Head Start teachers, called and told me that they had noticed a profound behavior change in the girls at school. They started taking part in more activities. They participated more in class. They talked more and seemed happier, smiling, and became more active. The teachers were amazed. The girls had never really complained about their dental problems. They just suffered in silence, not knowing the effects the dental disease was having on their lives. Community water fluoridation would have helped prevent this decay. I tell this story to illustrate how oral health affects children's health and their ability to learn in school. The other factor that concerns me as a taxpayer is the cost of treatment for dental disease. When I see a child under age 3 with 8 to 20 decayed primary teeth, the only safe and humane way to treat that child is in the operating room. The cost for one child to receive care in the OR with general anesthetic is between $8,000 and $12,000. That includes the hospital, the anesthesiologist, and the dental care. These children cannot be safely sedated in a private office, thus the major expense. The last thing I would like to address is fluorosis, the change in tooth enamel from too much fluoride exposure. The city of Salem has been fluoridating their water for at least 50 years, and from my experience, this is not a problem. The most common type I see is a little mineralization of the tooth surface, which is usually classified as mild fluorosis, that results from young children swallowing toothpaste with unsupervised brushing. It usually appears as a white coloration on the tooth surface. Community water fluoridation is the safest, most effective, and least expensive way to protect our children's teeth. I hope that you pass House Bill 3099. Oregon can be a leader in providing comprehensive preventive dental care to all Oregonians. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Doctor. With that, let's call up the other two folks for your panel, and then stick around. We'll have questions for you. Dr. Foray and Dr. Ashenbrenner. And just for the time check, since we got a slightly late start, we're going to 10 of on the proponent. So you have time. Your time is also being shared with the public testimony. So if you have written testimony, try to summarize it. Dr. Foray?
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the subcommittee. My name is Dr. Kurt Foray. I am a general dentist in Portland, and I'm the chair of the Healthy Smiles Coalition, which I am representing here today. I have practiced in both a fluoridated and non-fluoridated community, and over the years I have reinforced me by what I have seen in my practice, that fluoridation is the cornerstone of a comprehensive preventative oral health policy. I have been involved in the promotion of fluoridation for the past 7 years for this very reason, to improve the oral health of all Oregonians through prevention. While watching the politics of fluoridation from around the country, I have made this observation. As challenging as it is to bring fluoridation to a non-fluoridated community, it is equally challenging for our opponents to get a community that has experienced long-standing fluoridation to discontinue the practice. Why is this? It has to do with how we humans process and evaluate risk on what is commonly referred to as risk assessment. Every day we consciously or subconsciously assess risk in everything we do in our daily life. In tasks or issues that we are familiar with or have lived with, we use our intellect to process the risk while weighing the benefit. However, whenever we humans are faced with new tasks or change, often we assess the perceived risk with emotion, and the resultant fear can interfere with one's objective evaluation of this perceived risk. In regards to water fluoridation, our opponents know this and play to the politics of fear. But how does this politics of fear play out in long-standing fluoridated communities? Let me share with you a couple of examples. Palo Alto, California, November 2003. The opponents placed a water ordinance on the ballot that, if passed, would have discontinued fluoridation. Now, Palo Alto, which has been fluoridated since 1955, is a highly educated community. How did this vote turn out? The measure was soundly defeated 4-1, and the citizens of Palo Alto continue to enjoy the public health benefit of fluoridation. Let's go across the country to Burlington, Vermont, 1 year ago. Burlington has been fluoridated for over 40 years, and it is the world headquarters of the Fluoride Action Network, or FAN. There is an irony that this organization resides in a fluoridated community, and the FAN has worked very hard over the past several years to end fluoridation. Virtually every allegation that you will hear today was used in an attempt to frighten the citizens of Burlington. How did they respond? In March of 2006, they voted 71-29% to retain fluoridation of their public water supply. And just this past November 2006, the cities of Boulder, Colorado, and Arcata, California, both long-standing fluoridated communities, defeated similar water measures as did Palo Alto. Again, the majority of the citizens in these two cities who have experienced firsthand the safety and effectiveness of fluoridation dismissed the allegations of the opponents. While there are many people with health problems today, despite strenuous efforts by our opponents to manipulate data, no link to water fluoridation at optimal levels has been established. We are here today in a hearing room inside our state capitol in Salem, a city that has been fluoridated for over 50 years. Where are the victims? There are no victims. I would like to share with you an example of how our opponents misuse or manipulate data. You may see later this afternoon by our opponents two graphs presented today, one from New York and the other comparing Oregon and Washington, using surveillance information in an attempt to disprove the effectiveness of fluoridation. It is important, however, to understand the difference between research and a surveillance project and what each is meant to demonstrate. It is also important to understand that these graphs have never been published in a peer-reviewed journal. Research sets out to define causality and/or effectiveness. In this case, does fluoridation work? In a research study, a hypothesis is developed, data is collected eliminating confounding variables, the data is analyzed using valid statistical techniques, and finally the results are discussed along with the limitations of the study. In contrast, the purpose of surveillance data is to use this data to help develop public policy. The criteria for surveillance are not nearly as rigorous as the requirements for research. The goal of surveillance is to identify where opportunities for primary prevention may have been missed. Now, in the New York surveillance graph, only third graders were evaluated. Typically, a fluoridation research analyzes a much broader range of ages. Second, no attempt was made to assess the individual fluoride exposure or whether a child had lived in a particular fluoridated or non-fluoridated community or county for his or her entire life. And third, X-rays were not used to collect data, but rather a flashlight and dental mirror were used. So small cavities between the teeth would likely be missed. In the Oregon-Washington graft, you will see it is surveillance data again and not research. It is also important that we compare apples to apples. The Washington data includes second and third graders, but the Oregon data also includes first, second, and third graders. Why is this important? The prevalence of cavities increases with age, so including first graders would bring the average prevalence of cavities down. But the real misuse of data in this surveillance data incorporated in these graphs comes from the website of the National Survey of Dental Health. Now, at the top of each state's dental page, it is written, all statistics are based on parental report. This, again, is subjective data collected from parents, and this data was never objectively verified by trained dental professionals. In closing, I would like to share with you a quote by Dr. John Harris of the Center for Center Policy and Ethics at the University of Manchester in England. We should ask not, are we entitled to impose fluoridation on unwilling people, but are the unwilling people entitled to impose the risks, damage, and costs of the failure to fluoridate on the community at large? When we compare the freedoms at stake, the most crucial is surely the one which involves liberation from pain and disease. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Frey. Mr. Ashenbrenner.
Chair Kotek, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today on House Bill 3099, the Water Fluoridation Bill. For the record, my name is Thomas Ashenbrenner, and I am the president of the Northwest Health Foundation in Oregon. There is a wide spectrum of information and opinion on the issue of water fluoridation in Oregon, as you acknowledged earlier. And Northwest Health Foundation has looked at the issue of water fluoridation for now well over 5 years. We started with commissioning a study of children's oral health in Oregon, but that study was commissioned after we repeatedly heard from members of community organizations. Every time we'd go out to talk about issues of children's health, you'd get up to leave, and the next thing they would say, oh, by the way, the number one health issue for our kids is oral health. We heard it repeatedly, and we have worked to try and address that since that time and to educate ourselves along the way. By way of background, Northwest Health Foundation is an endowed foundation. We take money from nobody. We have no constituency other than the people of Oregon. We have no business interests to defend or promote, and we have no political interests to defend or promote. We strive to be dispassionate and objective when it comes to the review of science-based research findings and the evaluation of personal and community views. The Northwest Health Foundation has listened to diverse community voices on this topic. I participated in the 2004 Governor's Conference as part of the Oregon delegation to address oral health. We have reviewed current papers and research on water fluoridation. I have received presentations and research reports from representatives of the environmental community, including Mr. Foster and Dr. Osmondson, who you will hear from later. And we listened to their concerns about fluoridated water systems. We have heard a lot of passion and strongly held beliefs on this issue. And I acknowledge that it is easy for a person who has strongly held beliefs to look at a piece of data as part of a research project that supports their position and use that as the position and use that as part of their support. What I think is essential and what we strive to do at Northwest Health Foundation is to take data in its entirety and to look at the body of research and understand their conclusions. We have listened to the experts and looked at the research findings on promoting water fluoridation as a measure to advance the public's health and safety. We have looked at the research that raises questions about water fluoridation. In some cases, as you heard earlier, it is the same research. In conclusion, we have carefully evaluated the total package of research, the consensus conclusions and recommendations coming forth from the American Dental Association, the Centers for Disease Control, and the World Health Organization, and the 60 years of documented effectiveness and safety of water fluoridation in communities throughout the United States. The Northwest Health Foundation has concluded that fluoridation of municipal water systems is safe and effective, and an important part of preventive public health strategies to advance the health of children and all people in our community. We believe that it is time for Oregonians to have the same benefits of water fluoridation as are available to the majority of the rest of this country. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Ashenbrenner. Questions for the proponent panel? And I would just remind folks we have about 10 minutes left for other public testimony in the pro side. So questions for Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to address my question to Dr. Empey, but really I think any of you could address it. And it has to do with this ADA position with the baby formula, and there's a statement in it that says that parents and caregivers should ensure that young children use an appropriate size toothbrush and a pea-sized amount of fluoride toothpaste. Young children should always be supervised when brushing and taught to spit out rather than swallow toothpaste. And I've asked the question previously and was not able to get an answer, and I hope you can answer this for me. I understand that the reasons for not swallowing the toothpaste is because mm-hmm. we don't want the kids to have too much fluoride. What's the quantity of fluoridated water that a child would have to drink to equal the amount of fluoride in a pea-sized amount of toothpaste that we don't want children to swallow?
Well, generally, if a pea size is approximately a quarter inch, okay, in 1 inch there can be 2 milligrams of fluoride.
Is it two or one? Is it one?
Okay. I've heard both. So if it's a 1 milligram, so it's a quarter milligram, so fluoride. So then you're talking about 1 cup of water.
Follow up?
Yes.
So we want to be careful that the children don't swallow the amount of fluoride that's in 1 cup of water, but we have no idea how much water children drink. Correct? They all drink different amounts of water. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
So how can we control the dose, then, of fluoride that the children are getting if they all drink different amounts of water?
Fluoridation is a 20th century adaptation of a naturally occurring process. What optimal fluoridation at 1 part per million is simply mimicking of what our dental researchers in the past evaluated was a situation where they got maximum benefit of the fluoride, meaning a reduction in cavities with minimal amount of dental fluorosis. Now, on top of that, someone who consumes fluoride toothpaste, they found in 1991 is when the ADA put that warning on the back of a toothpaste tube. And what they found is that kids that were living in fluoridated areas, if in addition they were swallowing toothpaste, that there was an increased risk for dental fluorosis. So they put that warning on there to help minimize that risk. So Dr. Pollack has set in, so I think he has something to add to that.
Well, we're concerned about children swallowing too much fluoride while the teeth are developing up to the age of about 6. And children up to the age of about 6 don't drink that much water, maybe half a liter a day, unless they're being that's their main source of nutrition. So an infant, very small child, consuming infant formula that's reconstituted with tap water obviously consumes a lot of water. And so that's the reason why we've issued the interim guidance on that particular potential source of fluorosis. And we're limiting the amount of fluoride in the toothpaste, the total volume, and encouraging them to spit. The American Dental Association actually recommends that children under the age of 2 consult with their dentist to see whether or not they should, in fact, use a fluoride toothpaste.
A follow-up? I don't want to take too much. Is there somebody else waiting to ask?
Representative Green, I guess, yeah.
Okay. What do you recommend for families that mix baby formula with water? If the water's fluoridated, what do you recommend that they do?
Okay, we recommend that they use several different forms of infant formula.
One is ready to feed, where no additional water needs to be added and the fluoride content is controlled. Or they use distilled water. And a number of families already do use distilled water for reconstituting in formula, whether it's powdered or concentrate.
Okay. May I just add one thing, Representative Bonamici, that I want to make it clear that the fluorosis that we're talking about, again, is the very mild to mild form, which is quite barely noticeable by anyone other than a dental health professional. It is a cosmetic concern. It is not a disease. In contrast, dental cavities is a disease. And again, this comes down to the risk-benefit. We have a test case here in Salem, Oregon. You'll hopefully hear from Dr. Jim Lace later, a pediatrician who's practiced in Salem for over 30 years, and he can give you his observations of what he sees in his children in Salem, Oregon.
Representative Greenland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm reading from an email in opposition to this bill. It says, in March 2006, the National Academy of Science issued a 500-page report stating, among other facts, that the current EPA safe drinking water standard for fluoride, and it says in parentheses, 4 parts per million, is too high, unprotected for public health, and should be lowered. We've heard that the standard we're talking about in drinking water is 1 part per million. Where does this statement about the EPA safe drinking water standard at 4 parts per million, where does that come from?
Well, the Environmental Protection Agency has maximum contaminant levels for naturally occurring fluoride in water, which in some communities can be as high as 4 parts per million or higher. And EPA, based upon evidence submitted and practicality of water supplies, has set 4 parts per million as the maximum amount that should be in any water supply in the United States.
Chair Kotek, Representative Greenlick, in Oregon, we have no systems that are naturally fluoridated at that level. They're all lower than that level.
If I recall just a comment. So the fact that the EPA says 4 parts per million is the highest maximum level and should be lowered, even if it was cut in half, it would still be twice the amount that we recommend for the water system.
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your testimony. I want to call a few folks up while we have still a few minutes. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Bruce had a question.
Two quick questions. Is there, this could be answered by any of the three of you, is there a level with the level of fluoridation that we're talking about in this bill, is there a level at which it could become toxic? I mean, for an individual drinking water, say it's an athlete training for a marathon that's consuming huge amounts of water, is there no level that it will actually become toxic?
No, it will not become toxic for anyone consuming optimally fluoridated water.
Okay. And the second question is, fluorosis, does it heal itself or does it go away? Is it something that once it's acquired, it's there permanently, or is it something that time or treatment or any other factor can eliminate?
There have been reports and studies that show that the cosmetic or appearance of the teeth does change over time, that there may be a slight reduction in the appearance of fluorosis in a tooth. But essentially, once it's there, it's there. It doesn't get worse. And the levels that we're talking about are not the brown stain. It's the white specks and areas that we see in the teeth.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you. Before you dismiss them, I have a question in regard to the type of fluoride that would be inserted into the municipal water systems. And I've heard discussions on both sides. Are we talking about industrial fluoride or sodium fluorosilicate, or are we talking about pharmaceutical grade, which is, as I understand it, more expensive?
There's no water treatment system in the United States that uses pharmaceutical-grade chemicals for any of their treatments, but the level of purity of the products that is used meets the regulatory standards that are set by the national the NSF, and they don't they're not allowed to contain impurities that are greater than 10% of the maximum contaminant level, so that all of these chemicals that are used do meet the regulatory standards.
Quick follow-up. Mm-hmm. Thank you. However, in their condensed form, as the product is delivered to the point of dispersal, mm-hmm. Are they considered toxic chemicals at that point?
Yes, they have to be handled with safety precautions, as do other kinds of chemicals used in water treatment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are over 40 different chemicals that can be added to a water system to make it potable. And every one of them at the point of entry can be toxic, or is toxic. Okay. The other point I'd like to make is that that your question that you've just delivered is one that concerned me when I first heard it several years ago, and I contacted Mr. Tom Reeves, who at that time was the chief fluoridation engineer at the Center for Disease Control, of which a position he held for 27 years until he retired in about 2002. And my concern was, what was the difference between the water quality industrial grade and pharmaceutical grade, because they had a purity difference of 1.8% difference in purity. And what he told me was that the difference in that 1.8% was actually inorganic salts such as calcium carbonate, which are so he said, if there's a little extra calcium in the water, so what? I mean, calcium carbonate is a very popular calcium supplement. So once any chemical gets into the water, as long as the pH is above 4.2, there is 100% dissociation into its ionic components. And this has been confirmed by the Edward Urbanski of the EPA. It was recently, confirmed by Drs. Larry Beck and Michael Morris of the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor.
And I need to move on.
Who balances the pH if the water system is out? And that would be a question I'd ask, and that's why I hate that we have this condensed on such important discussion.
Okay. Go ahead. Representative Kotek and Chair Kotek, Representative Flores, we have a water fluoridation water engineer here if he can speak to that.
Is he on the next panel?
He is not on the panel.
Okay. Sorry.
But is there a water engineer in the house? Would you like to speak to that question, sir?
Sure.
All right. And we'll clue with that. I want to call a few people for public testimony before we move on to the opponent panel. Could you just state your name for the record, please? We're learning all kinds of fun scientific stuff today.
For the record, I'm Dave Leland, and I manage the state drinking water program for the Oregon Department of Human Services.
And Representative Flores' question about who manages the pH.
In the municipal water system, if he mentioned that if the pH is in balance, well, who manages the pH balance?
Well, fortunately, for the most part, the water itself manages itself, because natural waters in Oregon tend to run just a little bit under 7, so just a little bit on the acid side. So, we don't see really low pH waters here in Oregon. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
I guess it gets to the pH balance at 7, or pH level at 7 is adequate to offset the effect of... And, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for coming up. I'd like to call up Dr. Lace, Scott Ekblad, and Alice Dale. Is anyone who's here to speak in support of the bill travel more than 100 miles? We're going to have to move on after these three individuals. So if you have written testimony, you've signed up for testimony. I apologize, we're not going to get to you at this moment. But if you have written testimony, please feel free to leave it. Dr. Lace, would you like to start off? And I'd like to keep you to each 2 minutes, so
I'll keep it really
make
short.
It quick. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician from Salem, Oregon. I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. My comments are very brief. You've heard a lot of the previous information. I would like to focus in on just a couple of things that have come up. One, as you've mentioned, or you've heard that I've been here for about 30 years, and we do see a big difference in children who come from Salem and children who come from outside Salem area in terms of their dental health. We get to do the pre-op exams for Dr. Herringer, and we have to look at these kids, make sure that they can have their general anesthetic. So we get to look in those mouths, and I have these horrendous pictures of these teeth that come in, and so we see that on a first-hand basis, on a weekly basis, on these kids, and there's a big difference between kids who live in a fluoridated water system and kids who don't live in a water fluoridated system. I'm just going to close. You got my written testimony in front of you. I want to bring up one thing which I think kind of is glossed over here. We are talking about children's health. You have an opportunity here to speak very strongly for prevention in children. Oral dental health in children is extremely important. I, too, have been able to volunteer around the world in developing countries. I, too, get to see these teeth. I get to see a lot of other health issues related to that. Oregon, when we don't fluoridate our community supplies, is somewhat akin to going to a developing country. You can see the same kind of dental issues. You can see the same kind of dental care. We have sort of a passive discrimination against children right now. When you come out and oppose fluoride publicly, I think that takes the form of active discrimination against minority groups, against children who come from a very or lower socioeconomic group. These are the children who typically do not have access to dental care. The same kids that you're talking about with the Healthy Kids Program, these are the same children that come under your purview. You have an opportunity to protect these kids. I think it's up to us as concerned citizens of the state to step forward, to step up, and to say we want to protect children, and this is a great opportunity to do that.
Thank you, Dr. Lace. Right on time. Appreciate
it. Mr. Eklund?
Chair Kotek, members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Scott Ekblad, and I am the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health. The Office of Rural Health is a statewide agency located at OHSU. Our governor-appointed advisory body consists of 18 different members representing all the major medical and healthcare-related groups, the Medical Association, the Dental Association, on and on. I'm here to voice strong support from both organizations for passage of this bill. Most rural communities in this state face significant access issues regarding dental care, and prevention is really the sensible response, and fluoridation the most effective approach to prevention in this particular situation. As far as I'm concerned, the healthcare system, one of the reasons the healthcare system that we are experiencing is in the shape it's in is because it's a disease care system and not necessarily a health promotion system. Water fluoridation is one of the many things that we could do to try and focus on prevention. I also want to mention that oral health really is a vital component of a person's overall health, and that perhaps this is one of the most impactful things the Oregon legislature can do this session to positively impact the health of Oregonians is to pass this bill. It is so very important. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Scott.
Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, I'm Alice Dale, the president of SEIU Local 49 and the SEIU Area Director for the Northwest. I'm also a member of the Oregon Health Policy Commission, which has already expressed its strong and unanimous support for House Bill 3099. Briefly, I have spent roughly 30 years of my life representing workers in a variety of different capacities. I can tell you that I'm keenly aware of what it takes for a person to be job ready, to advance in their careers, and also what it means to have health insurance, dental insurance, and what it means not to have that. I also know for many workers who have health insurance, many have no dental coverage or have very high deductibles and copays to the point that they cannot afford to access the dental benefits they have. Having a healthy set of teeth is very important in a person's employability as well as their overall health. You certainly understand and know the difference, a person who sits in for a job interview with a set of rotten teeth and a person who has a nice smile. It's phenomenally important. There's a reason that parents who can afford it spend $4,000 to $6,000 on a set of braces and orthodontia coverage, because we know that healthy teeth and a good smile matter. As indicated previously in the Health Policy Commission letter, the fluoridation of public health is one of the 10 greatest public health achievements in this century, and yet in Oregon we really lag. For every dollar that is spent on fluoridation, we save $38 in dental care. Every U.S. Public Health Service Surgeon General in over half a century has committed his or her support for community water fluoridation. Oregon is a progressive state in a lot of ways, whether it's the bottle bill, whether it's public beaches, whether it's the Oregon Health Plan, whether it was the right for people who are terminally ill to make decisions about their lives. Water fluoridation is one of those public health issues in which we lag the country, and I would submit to you that it really is time that we act responsibly and we act consistent with our progressive reputation. Let me close by saying that as a parent of an 11-year-old, I spend $30 a month to purchase fluoride. Actually, because I have a good health plan, I've paid $10, but the cost is $30. If we think about parents who are single parents, who have a couple of children, and have to make a decision about purchasing fluoride at $60 or $90 a month, the fact is many can't afford it. It not only benefits their teeth, but benefits their bones. So let me just say that as we look at the issue of health care for all children in this state, that one of the first and most important steps we can take is to pass House Bill 3099 to require fluoridation in all municipal water systems in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for being brief. Any questions for folks this time? Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for being here. With that, we're going to move on to the opposition panel. And I'd like to call up Representative Buckley and Senator George. Senator George here.
He was.
I know he popped his head in. Maybe we'll... When Senator George gets here, we'll have him come up. But I have Kimberly Kaminsky coming up. And then Dr. Osmondson, is that the gentleman with the laptop?
Yes.
Excellent. All right. Representative Buckley, would you like to start us off?
Thank you, Chair Kotek, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County. It's a pleasure to be here today. Thank you for allowing me the time. I'll be very brief. I talk very quickly as well. I am proud to be a good person to kind of be the transition spokesperson. In 2005, when this issue came up, I was pro-fluoride. I heard the presentation. I am a liberal, and I believe that we take action, take care of people when we have that within our power. And the argument that this is what was needed to take care of fairly children without dental care is one I'm obviously very sympathetic with. And that's where I was moving with this. Until I started to get the same sort of information that you're going to receive today, the incredible number of reports and studies that say, yes, this is great, and the incredible number of reports and studies say, wait a minute, there's some problems with this. And what came down for me, colleagues, is first do no harm. We have to make sure first we do no harm. I absolutely passionately believe we should be doing a better job providing access to dental health care and every aspect of health care to our children. I back the Healthy Kids Plan. School-based health centers, great idea. Federally qualified health centers so kids can actually have dental work done. That is proven to be effective and not harmful to others. I fully support that idea. In consultation with my state senator, Dr. Alan Bates, we wrestle with this. We talk about it constantly, and Dr. Bates as well has yet to be able to find the study that is going to prove one way or another what this the validity of this issue. My hometown of Ashland has passed a resolution asking the legislature not to put this mandate on, that the city of Ashland does not wish to have this mandate placed upon it, would love to be able to make this decision itself. So given that, I just want to appear today and tell you that I've made the transition from being someone who was very much in support of this for the very noble and good reasons behind it, but I've come all the way around now believing this is not in the best interest of the state of Oregon and not the best interest of our communities or our families. First, do no harm. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Madam Chair.
Question, then Senator George, if you want to take his spot.
Representative Buckley, I will just offer you this. As a conservative who does not like to impose mandates and would like to have that local determination to respect my local folks, I will offer you a voter registration card.
Madam Chair, Senator Flores, I'm really happy in my district. But I appreciate it.
It's going to be great in our caucus.
Thank you, Representative. Senator George, you're on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope I'm not expected to run this computer because we'd all be in trouble. Madam Chair, for the record, State Senator Gary George, representing District 12. Going back to my first years in this building, we dealt with a lot of issues, and of course one of the ones we worked hard on was the idea of pollutants in our rivers and what do we do to clean them up. And we're still working on it, and we're not getting very far. But one of my pitches that I want to make to you today is that this bill does just the opposite of what I've been trying to achieve. And that is, this bill specifies that we will, in fact, on a town over 10,000 people, be adding pollutants to the water. And so I'm very concerned about that. If you take, I have House Bill 3099, I suppose that's what we're talking about. I went through and I underlined it and highlighted it. And here's what I found. Line 6, ensure safe drinking water. Line 7 and 8, ensure public health. Lines 9, ensure safe drinking water. 11, safe drinking water. 15, ensure drinking water is healthy and beneficial for humans. Ensure safe drinking water on 24 and meets water quality standards on line 29. Then the bill comes over and says that on line 7 through 9 on page 2, shall require water supply serving 10,000 to add fluoride. Well, the problem with that is, I can tell you as a farmer who used phosphate, that one of the byproducts of that is this. And that's the label, I don't know if you've seen this yet, and that's the label on one of the sources of fluoride. I've had several bills over the years that said if you're going to use fluoride, you must use pharmaceutical grade. Because what you're worried about is not only what is in the product you're adding to the water. The main point is not the fluoride, but what other components are contained within that mixture that you're going to be adding to the water. Now, I know you have a lot of people here, so I'm going to keep this really short. In some of the information that's been provided to me, I thought there was a magnificent statement. And this came from the 2006 March of last year, Journal of Evidence-Based Dental Practice. And this is a precautionary principle that they advanced, which has been adopted by the Europeans. And let me, if I could, I would like to read it to you. If there is uncertainty, yet credible scientific evidence, or concern of threats to health, precautionary measures should be taken. In other words, prevention action should be taken on early warnings, even if the nature and the magnitude of the risk are not fully understood. Well, we know the nature and the magnitude of the risk here. And the question is, do we care so much about advancing this agenda that has been around here forever that we would, in fact, force our local communities to buy into it and pay for it? But are we willing to go out ahead of what seems to be a growing base of evidence that indicates that putting fluoride into the water is a very dangerous thing? I want to give you an example. A few years ago, back in 1999, I was trying to get information from DEQ relative to the amount of chemicals that were contained in point source discharge, and I couldn't get the information. I was very frustrated, so I assigned my staff to start calling at the upper reaches of the Willamette and asked the following questions of the cities. How much water comes in? How much water goes out? In other words, what comes in through the water treatment? What goes out through the sewer treatment? Well, one of them was pretty interesting because it was about 11 billion gallons. 11 billion gallons came in, and about 10.5 billion gallons went out back into the river through the sewer treatment plant. My point is that we're adding another contaminant to a 110,000 hazardous substances list, and we're going to put it back in the river. Now, it's not only the impact, and you'll hear testimony relative to fluorosis and a lot of other things relative to our teeth, but also you'll hear testimony dealing with animal health, whether this is a good idea that our pets and our livestock be subject to this kind of fluoride in their water. So with that in mind, I fall back to that precautionary statement. When in doubt, don't act, particularly when evidence is growing that those countries that don't put fluoride in have a reduction occurring in their populations of tooth decay. Part of that is better dental care. And one of the arguments that I've made from the very beginning is, my goodness sakes, with what we're going to mandate these local jurisdictions spend, they could buy tubes of fluoridated toothpaste and give it to children who don't have the financial means at home to have toothpaste. And we know very well, I was in recently in Walmart, and this thing was about this big, about that big around. I looked at the percentage of fluoride. It was as high as any of the ones that were there. It's probably a specified amount. Now, here was the amazing thing. That was around $2 for this tube that would last a child probably 6 or 8 months. I mean, there would be, that was a large tube of toothpaste. Point being, that's not a major expense. That is topically applied, and we all know the best way to do this is with a dentist applying it. You don't want to ingest it in and have it become a component of your body, and particularly the waste that will be produced by this going into the river. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. We appreciate you being here. Questions for the Senator?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
And Senator, thank you for your testimony. I'm not sure if you're the right person to answer the question, but I'll throw it out there.
Okay.
Maybe somebody comes up and does know the answer. And the question just truly is the cost. What is the cost for a city of 10,000 or higher to fluoridate? And what are the differences in cost between the non-pharmaceutical grade fluoride and the pharmaceutical grade fluoride?
Right. Well, I think that's an interesting question. I don't think anyone would suggest you would use an inferior product or possibly even a dangerous product or one that had a label that read like this. I mean, seriously, would you even think about that? I'm a farmer, as you know. Can you imagine if I suggested to you that I was going to take a certain percentage of the pesticide that I use and pour it into the river? Or better yet, when you put it into the water treatment plant at the city? Nobody would agree to that. I don't know the cost. I know it's substantial. I know for a fact, because we do some water treatments ourselves, that this machinery is not perfect. So the chance of error, the chance of overdosage, these type of things happen in reality. And so the main thing is, if we're going to do it, let's require food-grade fluoride. And I'm going to tell you what, I don't think the public would object if that was 20 times what a contaminated source would be as far as cost. That's my opinion.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Greenup?
Thank you, ma'am. Senator George, welcome.
Hi.
If we're putting 11 billion gallons, is that what it was, out of the water?
That was one city. That was 11 billion coming into the water treatment and 10.5 billion going back in the river.
And if we put 11 billion gallons of fluoride with one part per million, water with one part per million fluoride, what's the volume of the river at that point, do you think? I mean, it must be 1,000 times that, right?
Senator, Representative Kotek and Representative Greenlight, you're absolutely right. We are talking about dilution here, but let me bring you back to some of the evidence that we discovered. And this is this. We had not only Senator Thomas Wild, who was my vice chair, but we also had volunteers that were looking into this issue, people with expertise in big degrees. One of them was Dr. Hausman, and one of them was Dr. Scott. One was a Democrat, one was a Republican. My committee, I'm the Republican, Senator Wild was the Democrat. We came to an absolutely total agreement on one issue, and that is if there are 110,000 hazardous substances we're adding to the water, and you add 1,000th or 1,000,000th of a part per million of anything to the water, and it's accumulating these inputs all the way down the river as it approaches Wilsonville or Portland, then the question is this. What is the interaction between thousands or 100,000 hazardous substances in small quantities on the impact on the body? Dr. Hausman had many, many concerns. He said, I'm looking at evidence that seems to indicate that environmental pollution in small quantities is a completely different question than when the EPA sets a standard and says it's okay to have this many parts per million inside of your body. Because that's one chemical, not potentially tens of thousands of chemical components in small quantities in your body.
Yeah.
That's why I use the caution issue.
Yeah, follow up. Yeah, I'm sure you favor eliminating toxic mixing zones in the river, but in that regard, I wonder if you could sort of talk about the relative contamination of a toxic mixing zone out of a chemical plant, say, compared to putting one part per million of fluoride in water into the river.
Right, and that's a great question. And it is something when you look at the total flow, let's use the Willamette as our example. If you look at the total flow, I mean, there are billions of gallons, many acre feet flowing down that river. The interesting thing is, though, is when do people utilize the river the most? And if for many of the cities who are taking their water out of the river, when are they using the most of the water? It's in the summer. What do you have in the summer? Very low flow. Concentrations go up. The potential of those concentrations to reach the level, particularly with interaction of other chemicals being toxic or harmful, particularly to small children, And, you know, as a grandfather, I can tell you I'm very sensitive to what we are doing today to these children. We're seeing too many things pop up that really start to trouble me as to where we're headed environmentally. In other words, why do we have so many children who are manifesting so many problems? And I believe a lot of it is relative to the exposure that we submit them to. And, you know, obviously, you know, today a person would want to be really careful with fluoride or any other toxic chemical added to a child's diet. So I know I didn't get to the answer, but I hope those concepts help you. You're talking about a dilution factor here. And many people will tell you the solution to pollution is dilution. But I have to tell you, there's also, you want to consider accumulation. You want to be thinking about these accumulating in the body, accumulating in the stream bed, and accumulating at sea. What's happening at sea that we seem to be impacting the oceans in such a dramatic way? This may seem very, very minor, but I'm asking you, as that report said, when you don't know, be extremely cautious. And please don't mandate it on our local jurisdictions.
Thank you, Senator
Thanks.
George. I want to move on to the rest of the
panel. Okay,
thank
yes,
you for being
you.
Here. Really appreciate Thanks. That. Ms. Kaminsky.
Chair Kotek, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Kimberly Kaminsky. I'm a lawyer and a researcher and the executive director of Oregon Citizens for Safe Drinking Water. But I'm here today in my capacity as a mother. I'd like to begin by introducing my son, Benjamin. Benjamin's going to be 5 years old in July. In May 2006, a peer-reviewed study out of Harvard Dental School showed that young boys between the ages of 5 and 10 years old who drink fluoridated water at so-called optimally fluoridated levels of 1 part per million are 500% more likely to develop osteosarcoma than boys who do not drink fluoridated water. That study corroborates earlier studies that were done on the fluoride osteosarcoma link from the National Cancer Institute in 1990 and the New Jersey Health Department in 1992. Osteosarcoma usually occurs in young people before the age of 20. It is intensely painful and it's often fatal. Treatment involves chemotherapy, high-dose X-ray therapy, surgery to remove the tumor, and surgery to remove the bone, and in many cases, amputation of the arms and legs. My daughter, Rachel, is here. She's out in the hall with her daddy. She's 4 months old.
Is that where she is?
2 weeks before she was born, the ADA issued their warning that infants should not be fed formula that was reconstituted with fluoridated drinking water. According to La Leche League statistics, 70% of infants are breastfed when they're first born. However, by 4 to 5 months, the statistics reverse, and only 33% are still being breastfed. By the time they reach 6 months, only 14% are being breastfed. So while here in Oregon we enjoy slightly higher percentage of babies who are breastfed, the overwhelming majority of babies here, as elsewhere, are being formula fed. Even when babies start eating solid food around the age of 6 months, the majority of their food is prepared with water. Hot cereals, pastas, potatoes, soups, they're getting a lot of water even at that young age. At the recommended level of 1 part per million, children 1 to 3 years old receive the full prescription dose for their age, which is 0.25 milligrams, after drinking just 1 cup of water. Fluoride has also been shown to have particularly adverse effects on individuals suffering from low thyroid function, impaired kidney function, arthritis, and diabetes. Several studies show that fluoride is also toxic to our dogs, our cats, and our horses. Fluoride is the only product that is added to our drinking water for the purpose of medicating people. How is it the state of Oregon is going to inform parents with small children, inform people with impaired health function about the deleterious effects of fluoride? No doctor would be able to mass prescribe medicine to a population without examining each person individually. Proponents of forced fluoridation are asking you and the legislature to mass prescribe medication of questionable safety and efficacy to every single citizen of this state, without consideration of each individual's health, and medical conditions. Fluoride should never be forced on anyone any more than any other medicine, vitamin, or mineral. If, as here, there is a question about the safety of a product, policymakers should err on the side of caution. It is unconscionable to add a substance to our drinking water which is harmful to babies, increases our children's chance of developing deadly bone cancer, and adversely affecting those whose health is otherwise compromised. If we cannot give fluoride to our most vulnerable members of our society, we should not be putting it in the water. Fluoridation is not a substitute for access to dental care. If we really truly care about children's teeth, we need to reinstate dental benefits to the Oregon Health Plan and ensure that all children are educated about proper diet and dental hygiene. We all have the right to choose which medications to take or not to take. We also have the right to safe, clean drinking water. Mandatory fluoridation violates both of those most basic human rights. For the sake of my children and all the children and citizens of this great state of Oregon, I urge you to vote against mandatory fluoridation. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Dr. Osmussen.
Thank you very much, Chairman Kotek and members of the committee.
Hi.
I'm a general dentist. I have a master's in public health and nutrition and health education from Loma Linda University. I work both in Lake Oswego and Bellevue, Washington, with two son-in-laws that are both dentists that graduated recently. For 25 years, I promoted water fluoridation. I will be sitting over here with these gentlemen and telling you the benefits of water fluoridation. What changed my mind, I'll give you some of the information here, but it was really my patients that first woke me up. Because as a cosmetic dentist, they came in and wanted treatment for this dental fluorescence that's just cosmetic. First thing I want to cover with you is freedom. For about 60 years, this house has looked at fluoridation and has refused to mandate fluoridation for 60 years. You're contemplating reversing their decision of 60 years. And that shouldn't be taken lightly. It should be taken on the basis of current evidence that is overwhelming that they were wrong. So let's look at how Oregon did by not fluoridating. How much harm have we really had? Let's compare ourselves with others. Here's a graph. We can see in this graph the red line is the United States. And if all you look at is the red line of the United States and say, yes, we reduce decay, that's great because we all agree we want to reduce decay. It is disabling. It is a problem. I've taken these children to the hospital and done general anesthesias with them. It is a problem. And we'd say, yes, it improved. So if we only look at the United States, we can say, yes, we have improved it. And yes, it was fluoridation. Well, we thought it was fluoridation. But when we compare other countries of the world, some of them doing a little bit of fluoridation down here, some of them using a little bit of fluoridated salt, which is freedom of choice. You can choose the salt or not. But you know, we can't see that there's been a big difference between those that fluoridated and those that didn't. They've all come to a similar endpoint. Good scientists, they didn't all agree. Some did and some didn't. That's the largest experiment. It's a worldwide experiment of many, many people, and we can't see the difference. Here's a graph of the 50 states of the United States and the percentage of people who are fluoridating, the least amount, to about 100% in Kentucky. So if we look at that, we can say, well, at 18, as you've heard testimony, 18 to 40% reduction in tooth decay, we will see a difference here, won't we? We'll see a difference here. But those down here have a lot of problems with decay. Now, the information I used had 19.4% of the people in Oregon fluoridated. We're down here. We're failing. We should cry about this, right? Now, hang on a second. Kentucky, up there at the top, was given an award for 50 years of fluoridation by the American Dental Association. Great award. They're also number one for tooth loss in the United States. So let's look at this. What about the poor? And we must always separate the poor and the rich because that's where I made my big mistake. And if it sounds like I'm criticizing these gentlemen over here, remember I sat with them for 25 years. I'm not criticizing them. I'd be criticizing myself. I compared the poor patients that came in to see me with the wealthy patients that came in to see me. And this, yes, it's just a report of the parents and their opinion of their children's teeth. But you know, a lot of times parents have a fairly good idea how their children are doing. And second thing is, this is some of the best information we have. We don't have good studies of where we're starting at. So we have about 55% of the poor that are having very good to excellent teeth. And we have about 82% of the wealthy that are reporting very good to excellent teeth. Now, what your committee can do here is you can decide at what level of health that you want for these people. Do you want to have them at the poor at about 55% good health and about 82% of the wealthy? You can do that. Now, pick out the fluoridation level that you want. What do you want? Do you want to do it down here at 19%? That's what we've done here in this house for years. Or do you want to improve that now to about 60, 70% of the people on fluoridation, and you'll have about 55% and 82% of the wealthy? Or we could be like Kentucky and get clear enough to 100%. However, we'd be about 55% of the poor and about 82% of the wealthy. So this body has not done harm to us based on this data by giving us freedom of choice. We in Oregon have done okay. We've done okay. Now let's look at this. Let's go on to the next one. Here is health education. Percent of children, very good to excellent teeth. Yes, 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 yes. Kind of staggered line. And a percent of children with preventive care in the last year. As we look at that percentage of children with preventive care in the last year, we can see that there is an improvement. It doesn't have to be by a dentist. It can be a hygienist or someone well-trained, school teacher, somebody who works on with that patient one-on-one to help them understand how to take care of their teeth. It is effective. We need to be spending our time on things that we know are effective, not on things that are questionably effective. The poor, they suffer a little bit more. They just don't get the message the first time or the second time quite as fast. And so we need to work with them more. Yes, this is New York. These are the counties of New York. Why am I not showing Oregon? Because we don't even know where we're starting. We have no baseline where we're going to start this great experiment of 3099. We don't know how much decay we have. How are we going to know in 10, 20 years if it's been effective or not? We don't know. Nobody knows. Okay, so at least in New York, they have an idea, but it still isn't showing as a benefit from that. Let's look at Oregon and Washington. What information do we have in Oregon? Department of Human Services said there really wasn't a good baseline. The Washington Department of Health sent me a letter again saying they don't have any basis but of where they're at and effect of fluoride on the water. But we have 19% in Oregon, 59% in Washington. We got to find roughly 18 to 40% as what's been testified here. Decay in 68 years old, I picked this data. Peer-reviewed, I picked this data because it's the best I've got. Show me some better data and I'll agree with you. But I'll look at it. And I'll evaluate it. But at this point, Oregon seems to be doing okay compared to Washington. Let's look at any permanent teeth extracted. Oregon's doing pretty good. They gave us freedom and it worked. Very good, excellent teeth on the low-income children. Now that's beginning to get a little bit statistically significant there. We're doing okay. We aren't hurting. Our forefathers gave us the option, gave us the freedom, and we ran with it and did okay. Why do you want to take away our freedom? Okay, confounding factors, generally they're in Washington's favor. Washington should be doing a lot better than we are, and we're not seeing it, let alone the 20 to 40%. Okay, and in some places we're seeing that more. Why are we seeing more decay? Okay, we got some testimony on toothpaste, and it was excellent, excellent question on toothpaste. When I first started looking, I looked at my toothpaste tube, and I said, okay, let's read the label for a change. As a nutritionist, I should read the label, shouldn't I? I hadn't done it for nearly 30 years. I'd just been passing these things out free to everybody at every trophy. Read the label, drug facts. I know it's a prescription drug if I give it to you to swallow. If it's on the surface of the teeth, then there are warnings and it's not a prescription. But you are going to be putting a prescription drug into the water. Okay, let's look at that. Drug facts, it says do not swallow. Very clear, been testified. Use a pea-sized amount. We've heard that before. That's about a pea-sized amount. I grabbed my toothpaste tube and I went... 3 minutes left. I went ding, 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 72 different pieces. 72, and it had 36 milligrams of fluoride. And guess what? That's about a half a milligram of fluoride per pea-sized amount. Two glasses of fluoridated water have half a milligram of fluoride. Call the Poison Control Center again right away. You need to put that warning on the label if you fluoridate water. Contact the Poison Control Center if you drink more than two glasses of this water. We need to drink much more than that. Okay, risk, dental fluorosis. That's why I'm in business. partly, is because dental fluorosis. I first of all talked about benefits. The research that's being given to you that it's effective is 20 years plus old. The recent research in the last 5 years is overwhelming that it's not beneficial. Dental fluorosis is not just cosmetic. If I took a key and went over across your car, that's just cosmetic damage. But it is damage, and people are coming on into me to have that corrected. Costs $13,000 to $40,000 if we're going to do good porcelain. Lifetime damage, because dentistry doesn't last forever. Maybe $100,000. One-third of children have dental fluorosis now, the CDC is saying. It's going up and up. Why? Because our dosage is going up and up from other sources. It's undisputed. No one disagrees that dental fluorosis increases with water fluoridation. 1,500 EPA scientists, lawyers, and professionals say no to fluoridation. In summary, we hold that fluoridation is an unreasonable risk. Dr. Conant's going to talk to you more about risk. That is, the toxicity of fluoride is so great and the purported benefits associated with it are so small, if there are any at all, and I showed you, it's hard to see any benefit. That should end our discussion right there. That requiring every man, woman, and child in America to ingest it borders on criminal behavior on the part of governments. It is. Let's look at some research. How much research has been shown to you? How many references are this is, you can look this up. This one is from 2001 to 2006 of the articles, original articles, on community water fluoridation. Several studies conducted in fluoridated and non-fluoridated communities suggest that this method of delivering fluoride may be unnecessary for caries prevention, particularly in the industrialized countries where the caries level has become low. That came out in February, well, about a month ago, 5 weeks ago. But that is a report.
Half a minute.
Half a minute left? Okay. More research, more. You can look at it. It's handed out there. More and more. It keeps on going. More and more and more. It's constant in here. There's not a benefit. Look at the organizations here. Many organizations, but many of them, and I've shown several of you this information before, several of them have grave concerns. One glass of water by the American Academy of Pediatrics for children 6 to 3 years of age. National Institute of Health says that for all other management methods, that includes water fluoridation, the evidence was judged to be incomplete. Okay, incomplete evidence. You're going to do something on incomplete evidence. Yes, CDC says it's important. But remember, just a little bit later, they say the actions are primarily topical. Fluoride's predominant effect is post-eruptive. It's not likely to affect decay. And that's what we're seeing clinically. Okay, my time is up. And I thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Appreciate your testimony. I have Paul Conant and Brett Foster on the invited list, and there's a gentleman, Mr. Keith McLaren, who has traveled far, so I want to make sure he is heard today. Is he still here, Mr. McLaren?
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the panel. I've been researching this issue for over 10
please,
years.
Your name for the record, sir.
Yes, it's Dr. Paul Conant, Professor Emeritus of Chemistry of St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York, and also Executive Director of the Fluoride Action Network. For far too long, this debate has been controlled by the dental lobby. Is it more important to protect our children's teeth than to protect their brains? I want to put this one part per million figure into perspective. They say one part per million is very small. Let me put that into perspective. I want to give you three.
Dr. Conant, excuse me. In the interest of time, this is a 10-page presentation. I want to make sure that we have time for the other two individuals to be heard. We are trying to wrap up here in the next 5 to 7 minutes, so I apologize, but we do have your testimony.
That's,
you might
that's fine,
pick
but
the
this
highlighted.
Is slightly different. It took me a whole day to get here. It's going to take me a whole day to get back. Okay, there are three numbers. 0.004, 1, and 4. 0.004 is the level of fluoride.
Just as a process point, Chair Kotek, in terms of timing, we were under the impression that we would have 50 minutes, and our first presenter was Kim Kaminsky.
Actually, Dr. George was.
Dr. George was, as we've been talking
Senator
to your,
George.
Senator George, excuse me, as from talking to your staff, we're under that he was on his own separate time and not part of ours. And we planned this down to the minute and was not part of our.
I agree with that call.
I mean, I understand he was.
Are you Mr. Foster?
Yes, I am. So.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you making a note of that. And I have to say that went on a little longer than I expected. So happy to go another 10-15 minutes. But to be very honest, I need you to summarize, and I know you traveled far. But there are a lot of people on the other side that didn't get to speak, and we were trying to keep it to time. So I'm going to lose committee members after 5 o'clock.
Madam Chairman, I will try to pass over slides in the interest of time, but it would be more difficult for me to summarize coherently than to stick to my game plan here. The three numbers, 0.004 is the level in mother's milk. One part per million is the level they add to water, which is 250 times the level in mother's milk. Four parts per million, as you've heard, is the EPA's maximum contaminant level. The level in mother's milk, what does this tell us? It tells us, first of all, that it's totally consistent with the evidence that fluoride is not an essential nutrient. It also indicates that nature had very good reasons for keeping fluoride away from biology, from the natural system. Toothpaste manufacturers agree that fluoride be kept away from babies, and now so does the American Dental Association, as you've heard, November the 9th. However, the ADA's concern is the increased risk of dental fluorosis. A more important concern, in my view, is the risk to the baby's developing brain and other delicate tissues. At birth, the baby's blood-brain barrier is not fully developed. This is not the time to give it 250 times the level of fluoride that is in mother's milk. This was a position that was first stated by Arvid Carlsson, who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 2000 and led the successful campaign against fluoridation in Sweden. Varner in 98 showed that rats given one part per million fluoride in their drinking water developed kidney damage, brain damage, greater uptake of aluminium into the brain, and beta-amyloid deposits, characteristics of Alzheimer's disease. There have now been 30 animal studies which shows that fluoride damages the brain. A study from China here compared lowering of IQ in children, and the estimated point at which IQ would be lowered is 1.8 parts per million in that Chinese study. There now have been 18 studies from China which indicate that fluoride can lower IQ in children. My son is getting some of those translated right now. You've already heard this confusion between concentration. Yes, the engineers can control the concentration, but that doesn't mean you control the dose, because the dose is how much water you drink and how much fluoride you get from other sources. The EPA's 4 parts per million standard, they asked the NRC in 2002 to review this. They took them 3.5 years. They came back with this 500-page, 1,000-reference work. And basically, what they concluded was that fluoride can damage the bones, can damage the brain, can damage the thyroid gland. Here's some quotes. All members of the committee agreed that there is scientific evidence that under certain conditions, fluoride can weaken bone and increase the risk of fractures. It is apparent that fluorides have the ability to interfere with the functions of the brain. Also, a possibility of the biological mechanisms of increasing Alzheimer's disease. It's an endocrine disruptor. Fluoride exposure can affect thyroid function. They recommended that the EPA's 4 parts per million safe drinking water standard be lowered. No community or country, in my view, that fluoridates this water should continue with this practice until a careful and convincing response has been given to this review. However, look at the champions of fluoridation from over here. The ADA, on the same day that that report came out, not having read it in total or studying the references, declared that it was not relevant to water fluoridation. 6 days later, the CDC declared that the NRC findings were consistent with the claim that fluoridation at one part per million was safe and effective and continues to promote fluoridation. Promoters use a long list of authorities. Notice you heard very few references to primary studies this afternoon. You heard a lot of anecdotal evidence, and you heard a lot about endorsements. But authority has to be earned. Both the ADA and the CDC, particularly the Oral Health Division, have actively promoted fluoridation for so long, neither is willing to admit any health concerns or admit that they are wrong on its effectiveness. Look at this famous quote from 1999, which you heard cited twice this afternoon, one of the top 10 public health achievements. But did you know that this paper was based on a statement was based on a paper which was not externally peer-reviewed? It dismissed health concerns based upon a single review, which was 6 years out of date in 1999, and had this pathetic, extremely weak demonstration of effectiveness. They said, look, tooth decay in 12-year-olds is coming down from the 60s to the 90s, whilst the percentage of the population drinking fluoridated water has gone up. Voila, cause and effect, one is causing the other. But as Bill Osmondson tells you, if you look at exactly the same indices available on the World Health Organization online, tooth decay has been coming down in all these countries, regardless of fluoridation or not. Yet this statement is cited worldwide,
and it provides a protective veil for those who want to support the practice without doing any homework, without reading the primary studies. Summarizing the arguments against fluoridation, most countries do not do it. It is unethical. The public water system is an inappropriate delivery system for fluoride whose mechanism is topical. It is ineffective, it is unsafe, it penalizes poor families, it is promoted unscientifically, and the chemicals used are not pharmaceutical grade. Most countries have rejected the notion of using the public water supply to deliver medication. Only 7 or 8 countries have more than 50% of their populations drinking fluoridated water. 90% of Europe does not fluoridate its water. Some fluoridate their salt. Fluoridation is unethical. It allows a government to do to the whole community what a doctor cannot do to an individual patient, forcing him or her to take medication without their informed consent. It's an inappropriate delivery system because the main benefit is topical. That's what the Center of Disease Control said in 1999. That's what it said in 2001. It didn't say what Dr. Pollack said today, that it was a balance between the two. It says the predominant benefit was topical. Swallowing fluoride to fight tooth decay makes as much sense as swallowing sunblock to protect your skin against ultraviolet light. This is Arvid Carlson again, Nobel Prize winner. In pharmacology, if the effect is local, i.e. topical, it is awkward to use it in any other way than as a local treatment. I mean, this is obvious. You have the teeth there. They're available for you. Why drink the stuff? Fluoridation is ineffective. Just want to make a comment about this New York State data. There it is, not collected by me, but collected by the Oral Health Division of the New York State, which is avidly pro-fluoridation. It's their study. There's the tooth decay in third graders from throughout the state, averaged by county. If you then plot the tooth decay against the percentage of county that is fluoridated, the blue line is what you would expect. You would expect to go from the highest amount of tooth decay with the no fluoridated community to the lowest tooth decay with the 100% fluoridated community. That's not what you get. What you get is this. There is no relationship. As far as saying this is only surveillance, it's not peer-reviewed, exactly. It's not peer-reviewed, but New York State leaked this to a newspaper in Syracuse in order to persuade them that a county with more tooth decay should get fluoridated. Fluoridation is unsafe. It damages the teeth. No question about that. It damages the bone. No question about that. Millions of people in India and China have their bones wrecked by fluoride. It damages the brain. It lowers thyroid function. It accumulates in the pineal gland. It may cause bone cancer in young men. And a small percentage of people, maybe somewhere between 1 and 4%, may be very sensitive to fluoride. Proponents of fluoridation counteract health concerns by arguing that they only occur at high doses. But they don't explain what high means. What is needed is a margin of safety analysis. Ideally, we'd want a margin of safety, that's a therapeutic index, between the toxic dose and the therapeutic dose of 100. Ignoring the difference in dose and concentration, in simple terms, if we fluoridate water at 1 part per million, we wouldn't want to see a toxic effect in humans at less than 100 parts per million. At the absolute minimum, 10 parts per million. For water fluoridation, there's a totally inadequate margin of safety. At 0.9 parts per million, lowered IQ in children with borderline iodine deficiency, at 1 part per million, increased uptake of aluminium into rat brain, dental fluorosis impacting 40% of children in the United States, increased cortical bone defects in children, selections of 56, 1% of the population sensitive to 1 milligram per day, osteosarcoma in young men, at 1.5 doubling of hip fractures in China, at 1.7 parts per million skeletal fluorosis in young males with impaired kidney function, a one male, at 1.8 parts per million lowering of IQ in children in China, and at 2.3 parts per million lowering of thyroid activity in the Ukraine. We don't even make a margin of safety of 5. And remember, you can't control the dose. No drug today would ever get approved with such a small margin of safety. But the FDA has never subjected fluoride to the stringent requirements for new drugs. And yet it is the most prescribed medication in the United States history, and it's being prescribed by people with no medical qualifications. Fluoridation penalizes poor families. Most poor families cannot afford avoidance measures if they do not want their children to drink fluoridated water. They just can't afford it. Fluoride's toxic effects are exacerbated by poor nutrition. Poor nutrition is more likely to occur in poor families.
Dr. Khan, can you wrap up, please?
I'll wrap up, yes. It's unnecessary because you can see that the level of dental fluorosis rates in unfluoridated areas is such that they're already exceeding the so-called optimal doses. Let me go, if I may, to my last slide, which is the summary of my conclusions.
Dr. Conant, you're cutting into the times of other folks.
I just would like to do one slide, which is a summary of my conclusions, if I may. With the evidence of benefits from ingestion so weak to negligible, and the evidence of harm documented by the NRC in 2000 so serious, with little or no margin of safety, especially for subsets of the population, forcing every man, woman, and child in Oregon to ingest a toxic substance at a level 250 times higher than found in mother's milk is utterly preposterous, especially a substance which is known to work topically, not systemically. Those who want fluoride's topical benefits can do so by using universally available fluoridated toothpaste. Those who genuinely care for poor kids would do better to put the resources frittered away on this chemical, delivery equipment, testing, and promotion on targeted dental care for those with low income. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Conant. Mr. McLaren, you have about 5 minutes. So I don't know how you want to do this. You've come all the way from Jackson County.
Well, he's much better qualified. I will just say...
For the record, could you introduce yourself?
Oh, yes. Keith McLaren, builder and concerned citizen. Thank you very much. You guys got a tough job. This is just one bill, I know. It's a shame that this chemist, the most qualified... I don't think any of us should be talking about this. I think it should be the scientists, and he's the only water engineer in here. It sounds like he's more a manager. I wish that we would give this question to the FDA to be examined if this is something safe and effective to put in our water. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that little chance, and good luck.
Thank you, Mr. McLaren. Appreciate your
time. I really do appreciate your service on this committee and for the state in general. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Appreciate your time. Thanks for coming. Mr. Foster. Can you do your presentation in about 5 minutes?
At 7. Good afternoon, Chair Kotek and members of the Commission. My name is Brent Foster. I'm the Executive Director for Columbia Riverkeeper. I'm also on the State Executive Board for the State Sierra Club. We oppose the proposed measure for a number of reasons, and I just want to be clear. I met a number of the people who are in favor of this measure. I know many people who are pro-fluoride, and I've got no question that their intentions are absolutely the best, and I share them. And since I was pro-fluoride, and I spent a lot of time as a kid in a dental chair, not with cavities, but with teeth coming in through the roof of my mouth in all sorts of ways, there aren't many people who sympathize more with what cavities can actually mean. But what has happened over the last year should be enough to kind of convince even the most ardent fluoridation supporters that it's at least time to take a little time out and see where the new science goes. If you were going to mandate, and today this is where it would happen. If it passes out of committee, there's no I don't have a good sense of where it's going to go. But if you're going to mandate water fluoridation, essentially I think the standard you should at least have is no reasonable doubt about whether or not there's adverse effects and no reasonable doubt about whether or not it's absolutely effective. You're essentially playing the role of doctor. You know, whether you want to, fluoride meets every legal medical definition of a drug, whether we want to say it's good to put in the water or bad, we know on toothpaste, FDA treats it as a drug. It's intended to treat, mitigate, or cure disease. Yeah, absolutely. When the Harvard study comes out, and this was a study that was published by Harvard in 2006, and it's published by some of the best and brightest that Harvard has in Harvard's Cancer Causes Journal. There was a newspaper article, the Wall Street Journal, that did a story before it was published. And I think that's led some to say, oh, it hasn't been published or it hasn't been peer-reviewed. No, it has been published. It has been peer-reviewed. That was confirmed by Senator Bates' staff after he heard that claims. It found a 500% increased risk of bone cancer in boys who were exposed to regularly fluoridated water. I was a little surprised, and I'm sure you'll hear in the rebuttal, why this isn't relevant. And I hope that there's more studies, but the reality is that is only one study of many in a row that have suggested a link between fluoridated water
and bone cancer. We know that fluoride increases cellular growth in bones. It's used to treat osteoporosis in women for a number of years. You can watch the bones get denser. The only problem, the reason why it's not largely used anymore, is that it also made the bones more brittle. The idea that you might be able to cause overgrowth in bones, which is the definition of cancer, when a boy hits his growth spurt, and this is what the Harvard study found, between 6 and 8, over 500% increase in cancer. That, to me, gives you some reasonable doubt. I am not an epidemiologist. I'm not a doctor. But it is enough to me to create reasonable doubt, and I think it should for all of you. If one kid gets osteosarcoma, when we have other ways, topical applications of fluoride, like Senator Bates and Vicky Walker have a bill to allow topical applications or have medical companies cover topical applications, we do need to pursue those. Similarly, when the National Academy of Science and the National Research Council of the National Academy comes out and says, you know the 4 part per million standard that we thought was safe for the last 20 years? Guess what? It's not. To be clear, Representative Greenlick, what the study found, while it was addressing that 4 part per million, it did not say that there is a safe level. It did not say 3 part per million safe or 2 part or 1 part. It specifically just addressed its task, which was to say 4 is not safe. Now, I work in toxics all day long. That's what I do. I deal with toxics. And usually, if you see a bad effect at 4 parts per million, it's a strong indication that you need to look further and see, is there more effects at 1 part per million? Arsenic is a perfect example. 2 years ago, the standard, if I was sitting here, or I'm sorry, 4 years ago, the standard I was sitting here was 50 parts per billion. Now it's 10 parts per billion. It's dropped a factor of 5. That could happen with fluoride is not hypothetical. I can't say it's going to, but again, does it create some reasonable doubt that whether the state should mandate this into everybody's drinking water, including many people, as your emails and letters to the editor will attest, many people who are very, very concerned about this, and they have read some of the studies. Some of them are uninformed. Some of them have read the same scientific studies I have, and I'll show you a couple of those in the rebuttal. The infant formula warning, to me, was just kind of the icing on the cake. It's not me saying don't give fluoridated water to infants. It's the ADA and it's the Oregon Department of Health Services. I can't tell you exactly what the impact's going to be, but I can tell you fluorosis because my girlfriend had it. And you don't see a picture of my girlfriend from the time she was 5 or 6 with her mouth open. And the reason why is because she was always scared of the little white spots that were on her teeth. And she didn't grow up in a fluoridated community. It was due to taking fluoride tablets. But you can't dismiss the cosmetic effects as not having psychological components, and that is exactly what the National Research Council found, specifically refuting the claim that fluorosis was just a cosmetic effect and therefore somehow didn't need to be taken seriously. They found it was a medical effect. One of the things that didn't get touched on, but I do want to, is the product itself. What we know, there is not a dispute that the product being used is an industrial waste byproduct. And maybe that sounds like hyperbole, but it's accurate. And the dentists largely don't dispute that. One of the problems with that is that it contains levels of arsenic, mercury, cadmium, lead, chromium. Now, the dentists don't dispute that either. But what they say is that these are at very low levels. Now, I'm not going to disagree. They're at the part per billion level. But the reality is, I don't want to drink any more arsenic. Oregon has 135 communities that already exceed our arsenic standard, that have tested waters that exceed it. Most women of childbearing age already have too much mercury in their body. That poses a direct threat, along with lead, to the neurological health of their children. And this, I don't have to be a scientist. You just have to be able to read the newspaper to understand that this is a real impact. It's not unreasonable for me or other people to be concerned about it. And I think it should create in you the type of reasonable doubt that says, hey, even if I'm pro-fluoride, let's let the science settle out for a few years. We had 3 of the biggest, to me, biggest events that have happened on water fluoridation in the last 50 years. The ADA issues its first warning, limiting use in children. That's significant. Harvard, the first really, or the latest, very top quality study linking it to bone cancer. And the National Academy of Science, not saying where it is, but coming up with a long list and the material and the slick glossy thing in front of you, there's actually some excerpts from that National Research Council where it says, we need to research more the impacts of low-dose fluoride on the brain, on the kidney, on the thyroid system, on IQ. Again, the type of reasonable doubt that I think should propel your committee not to pass this out of committee, to at the very least, even if you're for fluoridation, let the science settle out for another year. This fight has been here for, I don't know, 60-odd years or 50-odd years, much longer than I, and I don't see the need to do it. This is just to point out, this is from the National Sanitation Foundation. You have copies in front of you. This is a report to the Congressional Investigation. This is essentially the Water Industry Association reporting on how many toxics and what toxics are present in the finished water that we drink directly as a result of water fluoridation.
Mr. Foster, could you wrap up? Representative Gilster, do you have a question?
I do have a question. Should I ask it now?
Sure.
Are you close to
you know, I'll just end. Whether you're looking at the lack of evidence about effectiveness, the concerns about the product itself, or the concerns about the fact this is not pharmaceutical grade and it is not pure, I think it does raise a reasonable doubt. I appreciate the time and effort you've all put into this.
Thank you. Representative Gelser, and I'd like to spend a few minutes with a rebut for the end, so I don't know who's on the other team. Representative Gelser?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I represent a district that does have fluoridated water, and when you come to meet with me, and certainly reading these things raises my level of concern. However, the question that I have, has the state epidemiologist noted that in the city of Corvallis, for example, that's had fluoridated water for about the last 50 years, that there are increased rates of arthritis, brain damage, lower IQs, thyroid dysfunction, bone cancer? Should I be running home? And, I mean, all of my kids are healthy. My nieces are healthy. I haven't heard that this is a problem in my community.
What we're talking about, and just to be clear, you know, osteosarcoma. It's a low-incidence cancer. It's not something that you might pop up and say, you know, oh, gee, I noticed every other kid on the block has bone cancer. Their studies haven't been done. And we would support fully a comparison. I mean, they haven't been done on the national level, let alone the local level. And the type of studies, the type of epidemiologic studies that you're talking about, I, again, would fully support. But environmental toxicology, toxicological effects due to low-dose chronic exposure is the black hole of epidemiology. It is the hardest thing, and there aren't those studies, but all I can do is say, when you have the studies coming out, like the Harvard study that says, when we looked at kids who had bone cancer and we looked at what kind of water they were drinking, 500% increased chance that they were coming from a fluoridated community. That gives me some concern about what might be happening in the fluoridated communities.
So just as a follow-up, to clarify, you're not aware of any evidence that would suggest that children or adults in my district, because they drink in fluoridated water, that there are no alerts coming out from the state health department saying, gosh, we've got a big cancer problem in Corvallis relative to other parts of the state. We've got a big thyroid problem. The people of Corvallis have lower IQs than the other people in the state because they're drinking fluoridated water.
What I would just refer to is not the studies of Corvallis, but the studies that are looking specifically like the Harvard study that says in communities that are fluoridated that you have increased risk. And honestly, I don't see any reason. Either the Harvard study is right or it's wrong. And if it's right, and if it proves true after additional study, then yeah, people of Corvallis and Salem and other places that do drink more fluoridated water are at more risk. How many cancers is that going to result in? How many decrease in IQ points? I can't tell you. But I can tell you, I know for sure, and there's not a dispute, that they're getting more lead in their water, that they have higher rates. I mean, when the city of Lebanon fluoridated its water, its lead levels doubled. The level of number, and that was reported in the newspapers last session, I would have brought it. They had hired CH2M Hill, and CH2M Hill came in and said, yeah, it's because you added fluoride to your water. Most fluoride communities are fluoridated with fluorosilicic acid. It is an acid. In addition to the contaminants that are in the water, it also leaches more water out of the lead pipes. When the city of Portland wanted to lower lead levels, it decreased the acidity of its water, effectively decreasing lead levels. The same is true if you do it the other way around.
I've been more than generous on both sides here, and we have lots of information we can read. And what I'd like to is clear the dais and have a few minute comments, unless you're doing the final wrap up.
Yeah.
Dr. Empey? Mr. Foster, do you want to
finish, and then Dr. Empey will wrap up.
I guess I'd let him reply first and then do a reply after their reply.
I don't want a back and forth. I just want final comments. But you've listened to an hour. If you want to say some things that are in reaction to that, if you have some things you'd like to say, but let's keep it brief.
Chair Kotek. I just want to bring us back to some central points here, and that is that incredible list of organizations and agencies recognize the benefits of community water fluoridation, which I gave you, including the American Cancer Institute. So if water fluoridation was a cancer-causing practice, why would we see that organization on that list? I also want to indicate that Bruce Goldberg, the director of the Oregon Department of Human Services, supports community water fluoridation. I also want to indicate that besides that incredibly long list of national and international organizations within Oregon, we have several organizations, including the Oregon Medical Association, Northwest Health Foundation, Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, Oregon Academy of Pediatric Dentists, Oregon Board of Dentistry, Oregon Dental Association, Oregon Dental Hygienist Association, Oregon Dental Assistance Association, Oregon Public Health Association, and on and on and on, who support community water fluoridation as a safe and beneficial practice for reducing tooth decay and improving the health of Oregonians.
Thank you, Dr. Empey. Mr. Foster, 2 minutes or thereabouts.
One of the things I want to bring up, since I'm not a scientist, it just helps me to point actually to the documents. The Center for Disease Control, although it doesn't want to find it, but the Center for Disease Control has specifically acknowledged in its morbidity and mortality reports that fluoride works, quote-unquote, predominantly via topical mechanisms. That is the same thing that was based on the cover story of the Journal of American Dental Association in 2000 by Dr. John Featherstone. He looked at, do we get this benefit, systemic benefit that had been presumed for so long, and the answer was no. And this is a key reason why, when you look at the Center for Disease Control data and the data that came up there, and I want to highlight this. This is actually the cover of you can't read it very well, but that highlighted section. This is the Dr. Featherstone's article himself. Fluoride, the key agent in battling caries, works primarily via topical mechanisms. That's not me. That's Dr. Featherstone. The Center for Disease Control, Morbidity and Mortality Reports echoes the same exact thing in citing in Dr. Featherstone's article. When you look at these graphs, this is the graph, just simply graphing the data which the Department of Health Services, U.S. Department of Health Services, and Center for Disease Control, they have held up. Not us. They have held up on their website as the indication. And this just simply graphs it. And I've showed this top graph to a number of the people here who are in the room promoting fluoridation. I said, tell me why, if this is true, why should we do fluoridation? Or tell me why this isn't true. And I haven't gotten a response. And the data from the study, you hear the 18-40%. This is what the 18-40% looks like. This is a Brunel and Carlos 1990 study that you heard cited earlier. In fluoridated communities, there was an average of 2.79, and in unfluoridated communities, an average of 3.29, decayed, missing, or filled surfaces. The difference between those is 18%, and I don't want to say it's insignificant, but it is less than one half of a decayed, missing, or filled surface. And this is the published Harvard cancer study that found, if you look in the conclusions on the right-hand side, our explanatory net found an association between fluoride exposure and drinking water during childhood and the incidence of osteosarcoma. Not me, but major newspapers with savvy medical staff like the Boston Herald report the link between water fluoridation and cancer. 100 dentists in Ireland took that study and said no longer do we just kind of call for the reduction of fluoride, we call for its prohibition. This is the warning that was put out by the infant warnings by the Oregon DHS against infant formula. We would be, essentially the state would be guaranteeing that you're giving infants an overdose of fluoride, over limit of the recommended allowed. We can argue about what the effects would be, but it is over the DHS's and as well as the ADA's. And as an attorney, from a liability perspective, if this was something a doctor was doing, I would think it would create serious liability. And I do wonder what kind of liability it would create for the state as well if you're knowingly doing this, not accidentally. And this is the last slide, which is basically after the National Research Council, the National Academy of Sciences came out with a study, the Los Angeles Times and other papers throughout the country reported the same thing. In light of these, I think there is a reasonable question about what the impacts of water fluoridation would be, both the pro and the con, and I hope you can put water fluoridation to the side and that we can move forward with real measures like increasing access to care, finding kids, getting kids topical applications of fluoride that will actually result in real benefits. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Foster. Thank you, Dr. Rempe. And I appreciate everyone's testimony and the passion that everybody brings to this topic. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3099. Actually, reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3099 to mention that we have written testimony from a variety of folks in front of us, League of Oregon Cities, Special Districts Association of Oregon, variety of individuals, City of Portland, chiropractic doctors, Community Health Partnership, doctor from Hood River, and a variety of other folks. We'll make sure these all get into the record. I appreciate the written testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3099 and open a work session on House Bill 3099. You have this bill scheduled for a work session Friday in the full House Committee on Health Care, and I believe this is an important issue that we'd like to move on to the full committee. And what I would entertain today would be a motion with no recommendation to move it on to the full committee. And do I have a motion to that effect?
Ma'am.
Representative?
I was going to ask a question, if I may. I don't know if we need to move
first. We have the motion first.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 3099. Is that correct? 3099 to the full health care committee without recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Bruin. Question?
No question. we heard a lot of testimony, all of which is compelling. And I guess my question is, with what the plan of attack is at the full health care committee, are we planning to give it a good portion of time, even the full committee? Maybe I should be addressing this to the chair of the full committee as well. Are we planning to give this a lot of time, or what's the plan at this point?
That's a good question. Chair Greenlick, would you like to respond?
Yeah, I'm happy to. Besides being the chair, I'm an epidemiologist who studied this for a long time, and I can tell you that I have no plan.
Okay.
We'll work it out between now and Friday, including the possibility of not taking it up on Friday and letting it percolate a bit. Besides, I do not have a firm plan, but I think it is better to have it in the full committee and getting it out of the subcommittee.
And if we could wrap up, because we're going to lose a member here shortly. Representative Bruin, follow up.
I just want to know, and is the plan here to go straight to work session, regardless of how much time that may take, or is the plan to have more public testimony or a public hearing prior to this? Once again, I'll direct that toward you.
Yeah, same answer.
Okay. There you have it.
There is no plan.
Well, and one of the reasons
I
didn't
plan between now and Friday. I literally don't have a plan. And I think I'm almost, my tendency, I really don't want to push too hard, would be perhaps not to really fully address it on Friday.
Representative Flores?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I thank you, Representative Bruin. That really was the essence of my question. How much information and deliberation and time are we going to give to this very significant public policy piece that you are asking us to consider? And so I guess it gives me some level of assurance that you have no plan, and two, that you're contemplating letting it percolate, because I would just feel really very discomforted by not giving this the amount of vetting. So I would understand by what you said that even if it does move to the full, that you will be taking more input testimony. We will be addressing some significant questions as we make this policy determination.
Well, I can definitively say I have no plan.
Okay, then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I share some of the concerns about the way we rush through this very important issue, especially with people who have traveled great distances to share their expertise. And I guess I want to apologize on behalf of the committee for rushing it. I think it's a very important decision. I have enough information. I've been reading about this issue for quite a long time, and I think we should vote no at this point in time because there are too many doubts. about the issue. There's nothing that we believe that we need to make oral health a priority. Absolutely. I think we need to find a way to get more oral health care to children, especially in our state. And there's none of us who are saying that people who want fluoride can't have it. But there are too many people who are too concerned about the issue to raise more than a small bit of doubt. I believe Mr. Foster said reasonable doubt. I have a significant amount of doubt about the issue. So I would favor saying no at this point in time, because I've heard enough myself to have significant doubts and think we'd be better off spending our money increasing access to dental health care for children. And to respond to Representative Bruin's concern about the cost, we just received a letter from the City of Portland. I was going to share, I had some notes, that they estimate that an initial capital investment would be between $3.5 to $4 million and more than $600,000 a year in operating costs for fluoridation. I think that's a lot of toothbrushes. It's a lot of floss and toothpaste and a lot of dental education, and that's where I would prefer to spend dollars. Thank you, Representative.
Madam Chair, I would like to just respond to the question of the apology about time. We have 3,000 bills in front of the legislature this year.
I understand.
And spending over 2 hours on one bill is probably more than we've spent on any other bill before this committee. So I don't think there's any need to apologize, and I think we will spend more time on it before we finally consider it.
And one of the reasons I'd like to move it on is because I think the full committee should get in the conversation, because this is a large enough issue. I also don't think more public testimony here in this committee, I think we should move it on to the full. That's why we're the motion on the table is to move it with no recommendation of the full. Representative Gelsner?
Thank you. I think partly because we've been members of the policy subcommittee, many of us have been the great beneficiaries of a substantial amount of information from all of you, which I greatly appreciate. I don't know if the members of the full have done that, and I'm wondering if we might get a copy of the video CD to the full committee of today's hearing so as not to need to go back through this.
Excellent idea, and we should make sure they see a copy of all the written material as well. So with that, Aaron, could you call the roll and add?
Madam Chair, before
yes,
we do call the roll, as I've indicated to you, I had been a fluoride advocate. I think that there's been a lot of information that has caused me to start weighing the balance, and that's why I do not think 2 hours, Representative Greenlich, Chair Greenlich, is adequate time to give to something of this significance. I will give you a courtesy vote to move it to the full to have more of the members involved, but that's the level of my comfort at this point.
Thank you, Representative, and thank you for the clarification. Appreciate that. And Aaron, could you add Chair Greenlich to the vote as well?
Can we do that? Aye.
Representative Greenlich.
Aye.
We can do that.
Representative Gelsner.
Aye.
Vice Chair Bonamici.
No.
Vice Chair Bruin.
Aye.
Chair Kotek.
Aye. With that, we will move House Bill 3099 onto the full committee with no recommendation. Thank you, everyone. Close the work session. We're adjourned.